You're listening to Trending with Timmery, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics. National speaker Timmery Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember, helping Gen X through Z answer the call to true feminism and authentic manhood. Timmery holds a master's degree in biblical theology, and she covers this week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. You're listening to Trending with Timmery.
Well, we're all back from a busy Thanksgiving weekend, and I have with me today Father Tim Grumbach in studio.
What a great chance it is to be back, especially a little bit recovered from Thanksgiving and ready to get back to work.
I know. It was nice to have some downtime this weekend. I hope all of you are feeling the same way, and hopefully not too many controversial political, religious topics came up at the dinner table. Surprisingly, I didn't really have any controversial. Well, we talk about controversial things, but I think everyone who was together was on the same page, at least this year.
Yeah, I'm pretty in tune with my parents, maybe not agree with everything, but we're pretty much on the same side with most things. It was just mom and dad and myself, and it was good to get away from work for a little bit and just spend some time recovering at home. I was telling you, I think 3 days at home was the most time I've had at home since I was ordained.
Oh, gosh. So, yeah. An appreciation for you and your priesthood because, yeah. I mean, you have days you plan off and things change rapidly.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. There's always something there to fill the schedule. As a priest friend of mine says, if you're bored, it's your own fault.
Yeah. That is so true. And, you know, same thing with family life, having children. It's really, if we look at it, I think sometimes as I get older, I know, man, I'm so busy. I don't remember the last time I stopped like that. I felt this way this weekend as well. And it's a part of life. You know, this is, we have, the more we love, the more responsibility we have. And I was listening to a YouTube video by Archbishop Fulton Sheen, deceased Archbishop Fulton Sheen, for those who don't know him. And he was talking about how we need to waste our time, that the more we love people, the more time we're willing to spend. And because of our love, we will have more energy to get through what we must.
And we've lost the art of wasting time as a culture, haven't we? We need, yes, to fill it with something. Even from the youngest age, our children are, you know, they have the phones and the iPads in their hands, and they don't know how, they're not learning how to daydream. And, you know, we're forgetting how to.
Yes, my poor siblings this weekend. Anytime I can, I ditch my phone. I'm like, okay, everyone's here. I don't need my phone. I don't need to check it. I can go hours without it. And I'd be harassing my sisters. Get off your phone. I'm standing here. You know, let's talk. But one thing coming up this week on the show, we're going to be talking about the Women's March and how it's really imploding in on itself. And I think that's the nature of a march that celebrates the destruction of human life. We'll be talking about this new piece that came out talking about how the most dangerous place for women in the world is the home. Lots to say about that. We'll be looking at, well, what are the men that we need to protect women from? Maybe what are the challenges of where maybe men are being accused falsely of things? And we'll also be talking about the fact that it's National Adoption Month. Lots coming up about the transgender issue. Did you know that a waxing parlor is being sued by a man? I'll leave it at that. You'll come in a little later, hear more of what's going on. We'll be talking about the great successes of abortion in our nation. But I want to start by talking about the Women's March. Father Tim, it was really interesting. This past week, over Thanksgiving week, we saw that the Women's March, there's a lot of controversy. Teresa Shook, who is the founder of the Women's March, is basically trying to get rid of some of the co-chairs because they are deeply connected to Louis Farrakhan, who is very well known as being anti-Semitic.
That's right. You can see it in his tweets and in his speaking that he doesn't refer to himself as anti-Semite, but anti-termite. And so he's not only, you know, anti-Semitic, but he is bringing these people to below their dignity as human beings, even, you know, referring to them not even as animals, but as insects to be exterminated. It's a disgusting view of the human person. And, you know, fortunately, unfortunately, the Women's March is being drawn into this mess because of their connections to Farrakhan. And let's bring that out into the light.
And there are two co-chairs in particular who are associated with Farrakhan, applauding the things he has to say, supporting him, not disassociating themselves from him as he continues to rant. I mean, even comments very close to the shooting we just saw at the synagogue not too long ago. So it's a shocking, but here is a movement of this is what happens when you have a joint platform that is in favor of the destruction of human life in its most innocent forms. It's a form of genocide in many ways, and that's what the abortion movement has links to. And clearly here are women and men who are deeply connected to the Women's March who are saying, here, this is how far the genocide goes for us.
Yeah, and it's a counterfeit image of, you know, we as Christians being called to go where Christ has gone. Is it's even the language of one of the leaders of the Women's March said, I'm going to where my people are. And apparently that leads to, you know, Farrakhan circles and to be around this language. And so she's trying to explain away her presence at these rallies and her connections to Farrakhan by saying, well, this is where the people are. And I need to be with my people. But that's really who we are as Christians, is being aware of, you know, the darkest parts of this world and going there, not to support the darkness, but to go and shine some light in that place. And it doesn't seem that there's a lot of light being shined in this place with their presence.
Well, and it's interesting because they speak out so intensely against patriarchy, and they speak out so intensely against Farrakhan here. And Farrakhan, another thing that he had kind of been making comments or maybe even jokes about, beheading of people with same-sex attraction. And when we look at the issues that the Women's March has chosen to take up, they really have ignored most women in the world. They've ignored what's taking place in the Middle East and really the brutal attack and rape of many women in a culture that degrades women. We see in much of Islam culture in the areas that they have been conquering. And, you know, I look to what's happening in China, Father Tim. Mm. You know, we see women committing a suicide at a rate of 500 women per day, and that's because they have forced abortion. So does the Women's March really speak for us as women or as a population in favor of women's rights? No, they don't.
Yeah. And I'll be honest, my only connection to the Women's March is, you know, every year here in Los Angeles, at the behest of Archbishop Gomez, is we have our own March for Life there in Los Angeles. And it's called One Life LA. And it takes place the same day as Los Angeles's Women's March. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've spaced it out so that, you know, all those who are at the Women's March are leaving and going to their cars and taking off for the day, while the One Life LA people, while we're coming into La Placita and beginning to take over the streets in our own way. And so they've, you know, tried to space it time-wise so there's not too much intersection there. But it's really a strange dynamic to see, you know, all those pink hats. I don't need to describe them any further, but to see them leaving while we're arriving, and to know that we are marching and proclaiming the gospel for the sake of, you know, women in the womb, and for the sake of how do we protect and love them both? And it's, you know, it's a beautiful chance for us to strike up some conversation with these people who are leaving. But sometimes it turns into counter protest, and so it's that's my only experience of the Women's March personally. But I see that there's just a very strange dynamic as they're leaving and we're coming in. So,
yeah. There's this intensity there. And I remember the very first Walk for Life in San Francisco, what, over 15 years ago now, I was there. And I remember all the protesters. They had more protesters the first year. But the intensity between the two groups, you know, I remember the first year they actually had police escorts between the two groups. And I mean, they were throwing condoms in your faces. I mean, people were right out there fornicating in front of you. And it was really, really dark that first year. But you look at what is the culture of life and what is the culture of death. It's present right there. And it's present there in the Women's March movement. And it breaks my heart because I'm starting to see even a lot of online groups who are advertising a very anti-patriarchy type of message. I just got a message from some, it was just like some type of like women's hair products or something. And the email came came in, the title was Smash the Patriarchy. Mm. And I opened up the email, like I saved it a few days and finally opened it up after Thanksgiving, and nothing inside the email had anything to do with patriarchy. Mm. Yet there's just this attitude that's being used in marketing now. And I had to pause and say, well, what is patriarchy? And, you know, I think that what the Women's March would like to say is that it's a dominance, it's submission, it's control, it's separation. But that's also the same type of thing we're seeing from the Women's March in a very radical pro-abortion movement.
Yeah, and you know, smash the patriarchy, destroy this thing which has been distorted, instead of trying to go into a deeper relationship with it and to purify it, to transform it, to let it become something that's meant to, you know, protect both masculinity and femininity. Right. One of the most beautiful images I came across just this last week was listening to somebody speak about marriage, and especially the relationship between man and woman, and not as something that's possessive, but as something that's protective, is that the man must understand that he does not possess his wife, that he is not the one that is going to save her, but rather she has a space in which she stands before God in a relationship. You know, my favorite Latin saying for this is secretum mea mihi, my secret is mine, is that there's a relationship, there's a part of my relationship with God that nobody else is ever going to understand. And I'm not even gonna be able to put words to it. And so it's described as this holy of holies for the woman, you know, the gate at which the man stands guard.
I love that. Well, and if we look, Father Tim, at what patriarchy is where the man takes that responsibility. Mm-hmm. Patriarchy, it says we're going to place family and children first. Patriarchy says we're going to take responsibility for the children and for the women in our lives, not to degrade them, but to say there's something worth protecting and respecting. And if you think about it, this is what Christianity. This is what Judaism has brought to society. Christianity was what brought about consent in marriage, right? Christianity has really pushed for this protection and elevation of women, where we say, you're so important that I'm going to protect you. I'm not just going to disregard you or allow for the continuation of a rape culture or a lack of complementarity and commitment.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate that the attempted destruction of the patriarchy sees men protecting women as an ill of society, but rather it's supposed to be seen as something that is a good.
We'll be back on Trending. We're going to be talking about how apparently the home is the most dangerous place for women.
Timmery will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timmery, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Coming up, some excellent news about the abortion industry, the decline in abortions, and how clinics are closing. You don't want to miss this. Father Tim Grumbach is in studio with me. You're listening to Trending. Father Tim, before the break, I want to come back to this. We were talking about patriarchy and how, you know, the feminist movement looks at patriarchy as such a bad thing. And the things that they believe patriarchy is, in many ways, yes, are bad. But what patriarchy does is it takes on responsibility for another human being, especially for the family, for children, and provides protection, versus a lot of attitudes of what we might call the modern idea. Maybe we want to call it a matriarchy. We could. It says, I'm self-sufficient. I'm self-oriented. In fact, I can even be bisexual because then I don't have the responsibility of children. And, you know, it very really kind of implodes on itself, as we even see in the Women's March.
Because it's blurring certain valuable distinctions between men and women. You know, it convinces women that they will be their best as women if they're just better versions of men, rather than recognizing this beautiful gift that's expressed in so many different ways that is sometimes culturally conditioned, but it, you know, is written into the natural law and into our hearts that there's this difference built into us between men and women. And to lose that distinction, you lose a real gift of the way that we've been created.
I was reading something recently, and it was talking about how in many ways Christianity elevated the soul of the woman to really come into a greater understanding of herself. And I read that, and you hear a lot of this in this understanding when women understand themselves. When women are respected and are given that space to understand and respect themselves, society changes.
Yeah, and we can have such beautiful Christian philosophy understanding the feminine and what it means for to have the soul of a woman, like Edith Stein, Sister Saint Teresa Benedicta of the Cross, who was a martyr in the Second World War.
Auschwitz.
Yeah, that's right. She grew up Jewish and then converted to Christianity, became a nun, a Carmelite, I believe it was, and then probably had every opportunity to avoid the concentration camps, but stayed with her people, like we were talking about, going into the darkest places and going to be where her people are. And so she went into that place, but she could write that the soul of a woman is a place where other, it's fashioned as a place, in a shelter in which other souls can unfold. Mm-hmm. And, at the very surface, she's talking about motherhood, biological motherhood.
Right.
But she says that, biological motherhood says something. It's a symbol of a deeper reality in the soul of a woman, as a place where other souls can unfold. How beautiful is that, that the biological truth of a woman is something that expresses a deeper spiritual truth about who she has been created to be and who she will be for all eternity. And yes, we know that not every woman is called to biological motherhood, but that every woman is called to some kind of motherhood. And so the Christian worldview, what we believe to be the truth, tells us more, even more than what our bodies can express symbolically about who we are at our deepest levels.
And women will not be able to flourish. Women will not be able to help others flourish in the development of who they are and their souls if men are not there to respect and protect the woman to do so.
That's
and
right.
I don't care how controversial that is. That is the truth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That is the truth.
Yeah, the truth of the beautiful complementarity that God as an artist has placed into our hearts. And so that the relationship between man and woman is supposed to be, there's supposed to be difference there. And that's supposed to lead to some, agitation at times. And it's supposed to lead to also learning how to love someone who's so completely other than ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of complementarity as expressed in the marital embrace, mm-hmm. in the our sexuality that God has given to us as a gift. But what happens is that who has the language to speak of sin other than us in our Christianity and the philosophy and the theology that's built up over centuries and millennia, that we're able to express there's something wrong with us and mm-hmm. it's not the way that God created us. And so that distorts patriarchy, distorts motherhood and fatherhood. And, a culture that does not understand sin, doesn't have language to speak of sin, believes sin doesn't even exist, there is no right or wrong, is not going to be able to look at a sin-damaged patriarchy and say there's something good there that is being distorted. They're unable to.
And this is what we are missing if we allow this transgender insanity to take root any further than it already has. Mm-hmm. We need to bring men back into the fold. We need to bring women back into authentic femininity. And that takes the tough conversations and living our lives with great fervor, mm-hmm. with courage,
right.
with joy, but recognizing we are in the midst of a great war right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at this and I have to say, I'm going to laugh here for a second because this is just ridiculous. Another woman is being sued. Actually, 16 more women are being sued for discrimination against a man who claims to be a woman, and he's upset because women won't handle his penis and wax him. And I'm sorry for the language, but I just need to put it really clearly in case we're confused about body parts and how this works. Because here's the deal. I actually think this man has really been saved the pain since all these women refused to wax him. I'm just looking at this story. I'm like, I think he got the better end of the stick here. Not only is he avoiding the pain of waxing, Father Tim is leaning sideways. If you're here in studio, you can join us live on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. But it's the truth of the matter. This poor guy, do you really want to put yourself through that torture? And the furthest I'll go is have my eyebrows waxed. No, thank you. I'm looking at this and this man is actually making it so that women, first we saw in May, a woman in Windsor was sued because she refused to give a man a Brazilian wax. I don't care which way you say you swing or which way, it doesn't matter, you're still a man. And this woman said, now in British Columbia, 16 women, that's right, are being sued for discrimination. One single mom, for example, who's just trying to provide for her family, basically paid this man off $2,500 just to drop the suit.
Yeah, I wish I could claim a certain amount of holiness where my mind doesn't go where it has gone over the last couple of minutes, just image-wise and the language, the way that language can be so distorted. I'm looking at, it actually uses the term here, manzillion wax.
Manzillion wax.
This is a distortion of language and a creation of words that devalues the beauty of language, that, you know, God has given us the gift of language in order not just to communicate with one another, but to speak truth and make beauty known and to draw our hearts to His. And we're coming up with words like manzillion wax. I'm glad that you're able to speak with a boldness to speak of this situation as an insanity. I unfortunately in my ministry will not be able to sit down with somebody and say, you're insane.
Yeah.
For living this way.
I know.
But it's important for us to recognize that what's happening with language and a blurring of the distinctions between man and woman, that yes, there are really broken hearts that are experiencing this, and there's a lot of wounds coming from it, especially from the ways that they may feel welcomed or unwelcomed or uninvited into the church and into the experience of ministry and intimacy with the body of Christ. And yet I'm looking at these words, and I'm looking at these situations, and I can't help but to think insanity is a proper word that we must use with boldness.
And this is a really great example, because what Father Tim's saying is he's saying, yes, it's correct to call this insane. It's correct to say this gender dysphoria is a dysphoria. It's not something that is just something to be disregarded as, well, that's just who a person is. No, this is something where we need to help people. And that's where the reality is that when we're dealing with people on a person-to-person level, we need to work with them and draw them into more and help get them the necessary resources. But that doesn't mean we can still radically, with a great fervor, attack ideologies that are harmful. And that's the issue. These court cases, people aren't even willing to take up these court cases for the poor women who are being sued because they don't want to touch a man's you-know-what.
Yeah, because they probably don't have a stand a chance of winning this court case.
Well, they're afraid that people are going to label them as transphobic.
Right. Yeah, it's, again, terminology that has only come up within the last 50 or 60 years, right. Homophobic, transphobic. And yes, there is a reality that there are people out there who speak in certain ways that are demeaning and violent and abusive and could probably, generally be called homophobic statements. But for anybody who is willing to speak the truth about the reality of, God creating us man and woman, that to begin to speak that truth, the label gets thrown out at us, homophobic, and we become labeled in a certain way that, there's no way that we expect an apology or can expect an apology for being labeled that way. But that's a part of speaking the Christian truth, is it not? Is finding the right language, language that is given to us as a gift in order to make truth known, and to denounce this language that's being created in order to create these labels.
I want to talk a little bit here, Father, about a piece that came out. It was in the New York Times, and this young man ends up writing. He goes by the name of Andrea Long, and he has the title of his article, "My New Vagina Won't Make Me Happy." Mm-hmm. And it's really sad because he's recognizing in the article that making this physical change isn't going to suddenly make him happy. And he's acknowledging basically, I am perpetually going to know that my body is going to now treat this quote unquote new vagina as a perpetual wound, and I'll have to for my whole life receive treatment for it. But he still wants it.
Yeah. And the woundedness of this whole article can be summed up, I think, in this last paragraph, where he says, "Nothing, not even surgery, will grant me the mute simplicity of having always been a woman. I will live with this, or I won't. That's fine. The negative passions, grief, self-loathing, shame, regret, are as much a human right as universal health care or food. There are no good outcomes in transition. There are only people begging to be taken seriously." I mean, if that's not a soul crying out with real brokenness and woundedness and hurt, I don't know what is. And this isn't an article trying to defend, the goodness of transition. This is acknowledging that, transition is not going to give me the happiness that I want, but I should be allowed to be unhappy without people bothering me about it.
Well, here's the problem, though. So here's the reality of the issue. This man is clearly struggling. He is heartbroken, recognizing this will not give me the happiness I want. But just like basic healthcare, he's saying I should be able to decide. And there's a difference between want versus happiness. But this is the same argument. If we go back to the pro-abortion movement back to 1973 and before, that the pro-abortion movement was making. And we'll come right back telling you what that is.
Timory will be right back. tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timmery.
Father Tim Grumbach is here with us, and we're talking about what's happening in the transgender movement, and truly is insane what we are seeing happening on a level of lawyers are afraid to help people, 16 women in British Columbia who are being sued because they won't handle a guy's penis who wants a Brazilian wax or a man wax, whatever it is.
The manzillion wax manzillion. On the female penis.
Yeah, and he's like, my penis is female. He's sitting here saying, like, are you kidding me? But here's the issue. We're talking now about this piece from the New York Times, My New Vagina Won't Make Me Happy. And the author, he is saying there's a difference between want versus happiness. Mm-hmm. Father Tim, this is the same language in a different way from the pro-abortion argument, that it's about choice. It's about my right to choose what I can do with my own body. And the language he specifically used here is it's my authority to decide.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what's missing is the language. They don't even have the language to speak of sin and disordered inclinations and the end for which we were created. And without that language, we're unable to understand why we're unhappy when these things that we enter into and we believe about ourselves and we identify ourselves by our inclinations rather than being creatures of God and being baptized, adopted into God's own life to be adopted sons and daughters of God. If we don't have that language of sin, we're not going to be able to understand why we're unhappy. Mm-hmm. We're not going to understand that we are fallen and that we are not perfect. And everyone's going to tell us you're perfect just the way you are, or you were born this way. And the reality is, no, you're not perfect the way you are. And that's the only way that the gospel is going to be able to get into our lives. As they say, you know, sometimes the only way into a heart is, you know, the crack that comes when it's broken.
I think some of the most damaging things we can do to children when they're growing up is to just continue to praise them and tell them how wonderful they are without making sure they know that I expect more from you at the same time. There's a fine line between the two, and I think we have a generation that's been destroyed by maybe too many compliments and a lack of really encouraging, you know, you are good when you are virtuous, you know?
Yeah. When everyone gets a trophy, nobody gets a trophy, right?
Oh, gosh. You know how many, and I love, my brother played baseball, but you know, you have all these ceremonies for baseball today. And when he was younger in the little leagues, I remember every single child would receive a trophy or some sort of medal. And that's a great and fun celebration. But at the same time, what are they learning from that?
Yeah, I remember I was a part of a surf club when I got out of high school, and I was surfing all the contests that I could. I was, you know, up and down California, Santa Cruz and Malibu, Ventura, San Diego, all over the place. And I was just terrible at contests. You know, I did okay from time to time, but I was just not good at contests. But I was surfing more than anybody else. And I could surf pretty good in, you know, free surfing. But, you know, my club wanted to recognize me because I was surfing more than anybody else. So I got the, like, most valuable surfer or whatever, you know, they wanted to. And I was like, oh, cool, I literally got a medal for surfing more than anybody else. But then my friends were like, yeah, you just got like the last place medal. I'm like, you're right, you know, but I still get to surf more than anybody else.
But so. Here's a good example though here. You got a medal because people recognize your effort.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, we are called to constantly put effort in. You don't just get an A for showing up and checking out, right, but for showing up and trying your hardest.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for making me feel better about my surfing career.
No. For those who don't know, Father Tim spent many years in his surfing career before becoming a priest and joining the seminary.
Yeah, yeah. It was, it taught me a lot, you know, about how easy it is to stay on the surface and not go deep, you know, just don't fall off. Don't go deep. Stay on the surface. Wait, no, that's not the right lesson, right?
Yeah. I'll pass. I won't even put much more than my toes in because I'm scared of sharks.
Yeah.
So just one thing, we're going to move on here, but I want to mention that Michigan College actually canceled the Vagina Monologues. The Vagina Monologues, for those who don't know, it's a show really pushing diversity and genital, both experimentation and exploitation of the genitals. And it really was from 1994. Eve Ensslin wrote this to really be part of the women's movement at the time. But what's interesting is we've evolved from the Vagina Monologues, because now you can't even show the Vagina Monologues without it being not politically correct, because you can't include trans people, because that would really be a huge mistake, because it would infringe on copyright laws.
Yeah, we find ourselves in quite a strange place right now, don't we? Where we're actually defending the vagina monologues. You know?
And I'm not defending saying, like, nothing can be masculine and nothing can be feminine in our world. And we're definitely not pro-vagina monologues.
Right, but yes. But isn't that just the strangeness of where the culture is going right now? Is its great champion is now, you know, being leveled down to, well, let's just get rid of it because it doesn't serve our purpose anymore.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, here's what's interesting. I mentioned earlier at the beginning of the show that supposedly, and yes, I see the statistics, according to the United Nations, in this great piece by the BBC, the home is the most dangerous place for women. Hear me out, because you need to hear what's happening, but then you also need to hear what is the PR stunt behind this. What we've learned is that 58% of homicides of women worldwide have taken place from some type of family member within the home, whether that was specifically their spouse in domestic abuse to the point of being murdered, or another family member living in the house. Now, the area where we see this the most is in Asia, but we also see very high numbers, or the numbers highest of homicides for women is in Asia, but we also see the highest numbers both in the African areas and also in the Americas. Now, that's interesting if you generalize the Americas, because you have a big difference between first world and third world countries between the two. But looking at this, Father Tim, the reality is true that women are being killed about 137 per day in their homes. However, this is a scare tactic to say that if you have a family, if you're home, if you're married, that that is dangerous and harmful for you.
Right. And I think it was Winston Churchill who said, you've got lies, damn lies, and statistics in that order. please pardon the language. But that's kind of been my take on statistics for quite some time now. But it is helpful to see, you know, where are they? How are they trying to use these statistics? And, you know, it's a terrible statistic to look at in the first place. But we've also got to take into consideration, you know, the benefits of having a healthy home and the safety of a healthy home and how our Christian tradition speaks of it as the domestic church. Mm-hmm. And like you said, this statistic can be used to say that, you know, that married life and home life are not good, especially the traditional understanding of it, that it's outdated, it's not needed by our society anymore, our culture has moved on past the traditional home. And we also look at the reality that there may be a lot fewer traditional homes than we would like for there to be. And you know, how do we invite that into the church experience as well? But the domestic church is such a beautiful idea that worship begins in the home
with the family
and then comes into the church building and then overflows back into the home, that the home is meant to be a place where the children learn how to pray, learn how to, you know, show forgiveness, learn how to receive forgiveness, learn how to say sorry, learn mercy, learn justice. And I know that sounds like we're expecting a lot from mom and dad, but that's the church's understanding, that the church building is not the place where they first learn all these things, but a place where they come to bring it into worship and to experience it in a sacramental way where it's lifted up to God and transformed and overflows back into the home and so into the world.
The first responsibility of a marriage is the procreation and education of children. So that means that the home should be a place of sacrificial love and tremendous growth. But here's the deal. What we're seeing is that the home is really the place that most people, families, spend the most time. So in some ways, it would make sense that the home is also where we see the most damage at times, just worldwide and flawed human beings. So although we could say that the home might be one of the most dangerous places for women in terms of homicide, we can't say that it isn't maybe the safest place for women as well in another way. And so what this is trying to say is that if you're a home, if you have a family, that's dangerous. It's trying to scare, especially people who have maybe been physically abused, sexually abused, emotionally abused. This is a scare tactic in many ways to continue to break away at marriage and family, which is what is the Christian ideal to transform the human person and call us to more. And this is what's killing me, Father Tim. I'm sitting here looking at this, and as I'm seeing, you know, the BBC put a great piece together, I'm seeing all these articles. Nowhere do they give resources for domestic abuse. And clearly, domestic abuse is the issue that we are seeing in our culture. Do people have resources? For example, just one resource. Maybe you're listening now, you know someone who's reached out. There's a hotline. It's 1-800-799-7233. Around the clock contact, reaching out to someone. They also have people who speak Spanish who can help you if you're experiencing domestic abuse. You can also go to thehotline.org. Again, that phone number is 1-800-799-7233. What we're seeing in this anti-home push is we're also seeing that they're promoting a contraceptive culture. A culture that is contraceptive is a culture that also devalues women and says, I can use you for my pleasure. And that, in addition to pornography, has led to a major increase in sexual and violent abuse toward women.
Yeah, and like you said, it's this contraceptive mentality, which goes beyond simply the use of artificial contraceptions, you know, simply within marriage or without marriage. It's a mentality that decides how love is going to be fruitful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that can take place in how we treat, you know, the homeless, how we treat the immigrant, how we treat, those in prison, is I'm going to decide where my love is fruitful, how it's fruitful, and I'm going to cut myself off from letting it be fruitful in so many different ways. And so this contraceptive mentality in the use of pornography and within, and then contraception within marriage, it transforms us. And, you know, as a priest, I lament that most of the time when people come to meet with me, it's to share their sorrows. And I'm there. That's what I'm a priest for. So rarely do they come to share their joys. And so what I've learned over this year and a half is that sin first attacks the family, and that the second thing it does is it isolates. And without the language of sin, how are we ever going to be healed from any of this?
It's a return to the family. It's a return truly to patriarchy, which protects and defends family and children, takes on responsibility, sees men as protectors and providers, and they are the ones who help in making sure that the whole unit survives.
Timory will be right back. Tweet them at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timory, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Timory here, Father Tim Grumbach in studio with me. We want to let you know that it's National Adoption Month. President Trump has again said November is National Adoption Month. In the statement that the White House produced, encouraging family life is phenomenal.
Yeah, I was really struck by the beauty of this document. And a lot of people will throw it away immediately because President Trump's name is on it. And there's this great dynamic is that you'll see his tweets and a lot of people will blow up because of his tweets and they'd probably throw this away before even reading it because his name's on it. But it says, adoption affirms the inherent value of human life and signals that every child, born or unborn, is wanted and loved. Children, regardless of race, sex, age, or disability, deserve a loving embrace into families they can call their own. This month, we honor the thousands of American families who have grown because of adoption. And so he's not just talking about those who've been adopted, but the parents who have been the ones who have adopted these children, that families grow because of this. And, you know, we've become so set on blood as the only thing that makes family. When we recognize, you know, even in our faith, you know, Jesus Christ and his father here on earth, Joseph, that was a real relationship. That was real fatherhood. And Jesus, I would say, even learned a little something about earthly fatherhood, you know, growing up from Joseph. And that's because it was real fatherhood. And so please don't throw this document away if you're a never Trumper and can't stand anything the man does. Read this document, see the beauty of what it speaks to in the reality of these relationships and the need for strong families who may not have it all figured out, but want to do some good and want to continue to grow as a family to encourage them to, you know, discern adoption.
When we're talking about human development, the flourishment of the human person, and the document talks about how through family, through children, through the self-giving love of husband and wife, he refers to strong communities are born from this and resilient countries, countries, a people who can handle the heartbreak, the terror that we experience if we are strong as a nation. And I want to encourage you guys, children, when they are itty bitty babies, are loved and longed for to be adopted. Mm. And maybe you are someone who has the means and the ability to adopt, or I'm going to also say foster a child. Children who are in the foster care system, many of them who, especially who enter into the foster care system later on in life, never end up having any lasting home or lasting connections. And so maybe you're someone who could look into fostering a child, helping create potentially a forever home, or more importantly, a forever family that they can turn back to. Great news in the area of pro-life. We're seeing there's been a major decline in abortion. 38 of 46 states are reporting a decline in abortion by about 2%. In fact, it's really great to see, because we're also seeing at the same time that abortion clinics, specifically independent abortion clinics, between 2012 in 2018 have dropped. We've seen about 200 abortion clinics close over the last about 15 or so years. And again, that's an estimate, but we're seeing them, even Planned Parenthood, more clinics than that have closed. This is fantastic news as pro-life efforts are changing and saving lives.
Yeah, and pro-life prayers. You know, the boldness of those who go and pray in front of the clinics and bring their faith into it, where it's not just, you know, practically what are they doing, but what kind of prayers and sacrifices are we making for the sake of our country and ridding ourselves of this demonic force of destroying even the most innocent of life.
We can do more. And that's what I want to say. If we're seeing that people praying in front of abortion clinics are saving, what if it would, if everyone today were to stand in front of an abortion clinic and pray for the protection of human life, and we were to know that only one child was saved from that, would it be worth it? And the answer is yes. And the even greater answer is that far more children than that are being saved when we are physically present between Satan in that abortion clinic and that child and that mother whose soul is about to be destroyed by abortion. And so we're seeing, again, a closing in abortion clinics, a decline in numbers. This is fantastic news and we need to celebrate it. But I also want to challenge, what are you doing this Advent? Could you maybe make a commitment this time of purging from our lives and awaiting our Lord to start praying from the abortion clinic, awaiting the birth of that child for that mother who doesn't want to await that birth?
Yeah, and just to let her know that she's not alone. And I think so often that walk is made alone, sometimes forced into it, sometimes without even realizing that loneliness is in one's heart. And for us to know, you know, you may not feel it, but there's a loneliness in your heart right now. You know, and people, oh, you can't tell me how I feel. You can't tell me what I should be feeling. And it's like, well, no, let us invite you into the reality that you're not alone at this moment. And these women aren't going to know that they're not alone if they're literally walking in there alone and there's nobody standing out there to say, hey, we're here with you. We don't want you going in there. We want you walking with us because we want to walk with you. And so physically be there. You know, bring your prayers, bring everything, bring, you know, knowing that you are not going to fix this, but your prayers are.
That's my challenge to you this Lent. And we're going to be talking with Father Tim in the next episode about what you can do this Advent to really enrich the spiritual season, not just the material season of Christmas. And so we'll be talking about that a little later on. But Father Tim, really a neat time to look at what's going on in our culture and really seek to celebrate the good things of the Christian life. And I think one of the opportunities we have right now is the celebration of St. Nicholas Feast Day coming up on December 6th. You know, I think that especially for families with children, we're living in a time with when persecution, sacrifice, and generosity are all things that the Christian lifestyle either needs or needs to be ready for. And St. Nicholas himself, really, I think it could be a great teaching lesson for young children.
Yeah, he's become such a distorted image. Mm-hmm. We all grow up with Santa Claus, you know, this big jolly fellow with the red suit and the big beard. And one of my favorite moments in the Chronicles of Narnia, C.S. Lewis has this great image of Father Christmas arrives, you know, and he's juxtaposed with the image of the white witch who has created Narnia into this place that is, you know, it's always winter and never Christmas. And she gives, you know, to Edmund, you know, his great desire of Turkish delight, and it runs out, and he becomes all about, I want more, I want more. And she begins to use the gift to use him. But then, you know, his siblings arrive in Narnia, you know, Peter and Susan and Lucy, and they're on the run from the witch, and they come across, as winter begins to fade and Christmas is coming, Father Christmas arrives, and it says that he's, you know, in our world, you know, he's kind of jolly and maybe a little bit big, but he describes, C.S. Lewis describes Father Christmas as, you know, this larger than life figure whose his beard is flowing over his chest like a waterfall, and he's, you know, not just jolly, but solemn. And he gives the children these gifts. You know, he gives Peter the sword and Susan the bow and arrow and Lucy the little dagger, but also a potion to help, you know, cure those who've been wounded and sick. And so he gives them these gifts that are meant to make them into gifts, to defend Narnia rather than to make them obsessed with, I want more. And then he doesn't use them with these gifts. So, you know, that comes from the real image of who St. Nicholas really was.
And he is a man of the 4th century. He's a bishop of Myra of Lycia. And he is one story. He's well known for helping to rescue a family who was impoverished. The dad was going to sell, I believe, his 3 daughters into slavery. Mm-hmm. And St. Nicholas started taking, you know, just a little rag, filling it with money, and was throwing coin purses. He's known for maybe throwing it through a window, setting it on the windowsill, or dropping it down a chimney so that the family wouldn't have to sell these 3 daughters into slavery. And it's such a great example, because what St. Nicholas did is he helped people. He was known for even helping people with their needs. It said that, I don't know how he could have known, but he would be there, he would show up, he would give us the things we needed. Yet at the same time, he fought against idolatry and the imperial cult that was trying to force the people of the time to bow down to false idols.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was also involved, as legends tell us, with the Council of Nicaea and, you know, fighting against the great heretic Arius. And, you know, if you don't know the Arian heresy, it's this understanding, trying to protect God in his divinity, and not to have God have actually come down into this world, this place of dirt and grime and death and sin, but rather God sent his most exalted creature, the Christ, Jesus.
So it says that Jesus isn't God. He's not divine.
Right. You know, he's something special, but he's not divine. He's not actually God. And so this is the Arian heresy. And so the legend has good old Saint Nick slapping or punching, it depends on how violent you want him to be, Arius at the council itself. And so you can only imagine, you know, it's so hard for us to imagine anything other than, you know, jolly Saint Nick, you know, full red suit and big flowing white beard, just laying it into Arius. And so, you know, one of the great memes that has come out of this was, you know, this ancient icon of Saint Nicholas, you know, no red, no beard. It just says, you know, I've come to give presents to children and to slap heretics, and I'm all out of presents, you know.
Well, and what was interesting, if you read the stories, it said that after he ends up punching Arian for basically a lot of, he ends up being put on like some sort of arrest. He's in trouble now, and he's not able to practice his priestly ministry. And so what it said is that basically all of the other, you know, priests and bishops are trying, really the bishops trying to say, well, what are we going to do? You know, he actually did this out of great love of saying, like, we need to defend what the Catholic Church teaches. And so I believe it was a vision of Our Lady that came to one of the bishops saying, you know, you need to let St. Nicholas go. He's defending the truth. And this council is actually where we get the Nicene Creed, where we understand that God is consubstantial with the Father, of the same substance of the Father. Jesus Christ is Lord. He is God. Father Tim, where can people find you on social media?
You can find me on Twitter at Father Tim Grumbach, and on Instagram at Father Daddy Wop.
Father Daddy Wop. I'm going to tweet out some links as well, and I'll link Father Tim Grumbach. Maybe whether it's on December 6th or maybe Christmas night, you help your children understand who St. Nicholas is, the celebration of the Christmas stockings, or maybe on the 6th you set out shoes and teach them about generosity, sacrifice, persecution, and how to endure with great love, but great courage.
This has been Trending with Timory. To learn more about Timory Millington, visit timory.com.